I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Rabbi Manus Friedman, discussing the lessons of the pandemic. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Two Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Two Jewish is paid for by Two Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. Tomorrow marks the summer solstice, the time of year when sunrise is earliest and sunset latest, long days of heat, and especially light. While we here in the American Southwest lack the midnight sun experience of Alaska or Scandinavia, days are definitely as long as they will be all year, over 14 hours a day of light. Light is a kind of scientific paradox, by the way, made up of both waves and particles, the only thing in the universe that is both. Light is actually packets of energy being distributed from a source. And as such, it provides the impetus for much of existence. Light stimulates chlorophyll in plants so that they grow, forming the ecological basis for the entire population of our planet. In Jewish tradition, light is associated first and foremost with God. The first words God speaks in the Torah are Yehi Or, let there be light. And the opening section of Genesis is focused primarily on distinctions and qualities of different manifestations of light, the lights of the day and the night, the various stars, and the regularization of a distinction between light and darkness, light in its most primal form. Light becomes, in Bereishit, in Genesis, a symbol of God's presence in the universe, God ordering the energy of the world into the elements that create structure and purpose. As it says, God created light, God saw the light, and God saw that it was good. There are many different words for light in Hebrew and Judaism. Or, the all-purpose term. Ziv, the divine emanation that comes from the Ein Sof, the mystical ideal of God, light energy without limitation. Or Adonai, the glowing expression of God's presence. Even the Shekhinah itself, the divine presence, is sometimes expressed as light. Light is not only central in Judaism, you could say that it is at the heart of the Jewish understanding of God. Every aspect of God's influence in the world can actually be expressed as a form of light. Each element of Jewish tradition embraces a different illuminated expression of the divine presence. Light is good, created by God. But in a deeper sense, light is actually part of God, an emanation from God, if you will. In a way, when we see light, we kind of see God. So this time of great light here in the Northern Hemisphere should be, in its own way, a season of particular holiness. These very long summer days lend themselves to a certain slowness, and that should give each of us the chance to appreciate just what we have and what light means in our own lives. Here where I live in Tucson, Arizona, in the boiling American Southwest, we are particular experts on the subject of light. Experiencing well over 320 sunny days a year, most of any American city, in Tucson we are likely to begin to take light for granted. We even object to it from time to time. Ay, another sunny day in the desert. What else is new? Perhaps it will rain finally. We certainly need it. And yet those long days of summer have more meaning than that, for light is a gift. Poet Michael Lunig writes beautifully of how light fills this season. We welcome summer and the glorious blessing of light. We are rich with light. We are loved by the sun. Let us empty our hearts into the brilliance. Let us pour our darkness into the glorious, forgiving light. For this loving abundance, let us give thanks and offer our joy. We are experiencing a kind of crazy heat wave now, even for Tucson in the summer. Days not just over 100 degrees, that's nothing for us, but well over 110 degrees. That's foolishly hot. It's easy to associate heat with light, of course, and resent it. But the truth is that light is indeed a gift. And whether or not we are praying now for rain, and we are, not just as Jews, but all across the American Southwest and West, we should be praying for rain, we still should continue to feel gratitude for the divine gift of illumination in all of its senses. Take a moment today, on this extremely long day, to thank God for the amazingly great gift of light, even if it's just too darn hot outside. And so to play us in this morning, here's a song by Rabbi Yitzi Hurwitz, Shine a Little Light, featuring a wide variety of Israeli and other Jewish singing stars, from Benny Friedman, the Yehoram Gaon, the Mordechai Ben David, to the Maccabees. Yitzi Hurwitz wrote this song before he was diagnosed with ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease. It's called Shine a Little Light.
Can't you see I'm trying to be all that you want of me? But it's so cold now, it's so dark here. What could I do? It's not very clear.
Shine a little light, show us the way, lead us to
If I'm a little light, you're a little light. Together we are so very bright. A little light here,
a little light there. See the smiles, it's so very clear.
Shine a little light, show us the way. Lead us to a brighter day. Shine a little light,
show us the way, lead us to a brighter day.
Shine a little light, show us the way, lead us to a brighter day. Shine a little light, show us the way.
Thank you.
That was Yitzi Hurwitz's Shine a Little Light, kind of a Jewish We Are the World, maybe. When we return on To Jewish in a moment, our guest, Rabbi Manus Friedman, author, philosopher, chassid, and thinker, will explore the lessons we've learned from the pandemic and the lessons we should have learned. Hear all about it when we return in a moment on To Jewish.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson. Enterprise of the Pasquayaki tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this summer. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has already created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services Friday night and Saturday, youth education and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha's synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road on the north side of Ina, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property in our very own building. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Join us in person Friday night and Saturday morning. You can come by emailing me, rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org, or just show up. Join us every Friday night in person or on our Facebook page for Shabbat Live evening celebration services at 6:30 p.m., Saturday Shabbat morning Torah studies at 9 a.m., and services are at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Our Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, Beitsimcha Tucson, and we will continue to hold our services with full music in person and by virtual experience weekly. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are live and on Zoom. You can access those by emailing rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org. And our wonderful religious school is available in blended formats, some students live and some on Zoom. Sign up now. In fact, for more information about Congregation Beit Simcha to attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes programs, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation, high school programs, and rich array of adult education academy courses and outreach classes to become Jewish if you want, all taught in person and on Zoom, and of course, all of our wonderful services in person or on Facebook. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest and fastest growing Jewish community and synagogue in all of southern Arizona in its exciting and fun beginning years. We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Rabbi Manus Friedman is, of course, a rabbi with Chabad, a shliach, an author, a social philosopher and public speaker, and a past guest of Two Jewish. He's here to talk about what we can learn from the experience, this rather remarkable experience of pandemic, which has been so challenging for so many of us. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Thank you for the invitation.
How do we take what I think many of us have seen as a kind of a curse and turn it into a blessing?
Well, I was hoping that we would come away from this whole thing much wiser, smarter, more mature. Our relationships improved, our focus on what life is really all about, rather than just go back to business as usual. No? That there would be a new norm, not go back to the old norm. And that was in business. The workspace, the work environment, now that we look back at it, was so toxic. It was so unhealthy. the anxiety, the stress, the competition, the greed, the rat race. It was so unhealthy. And we had accepted it as if it was normal. I hope we don't go back to that. Schools need to reinvent themselves. They've become quite irrelevant, ineffective. Hopefully we'll have a much better model of how to teach. I was hoping airports would improve their service.
I'm not so sure about that last one, absolutely.
Yeah, I was laughing about it.
Yeah, I thought so.
The last trips I took, same old stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Look, we're human beings, right? We are inherently imperfect. On Earth, the broken orb, and Heaven, the round complete. We know that perfection belongs to God and not to us, but how do we go about changing things? Yes, some things will go back just how they were, perhaps, but boy, you would think we had learned something from all of this. What do you think the secret is to approaching things differently at this point?
Yeah, and to a great degree, it did happen. There's been a vast improvement, because we've discovered that we can actually have a life without shopping, without nightclubs, sports events, without having to hop on an airplane and go somewhere. We redefined what life is, and that's very healthy.
It seems...
So we have become more mature, and we have better focus on the values in life. I know many couples experienced a lot of stress being locked in the house together, but I think more than that, couples who were not doing so well rediscovered each other, and they're appreciating each other, having each other. So there have been some very, very significant improvements. The main thing is understanding our needs. We thought we needed all that stuff. Now we realize we don't need it. We never did. So then, what do we need? And how needy are we really? It turns out, if we were really, really mature, we would appreciate the fact that we really don't need anything. Don't need anything. This is what the COVID brought out in us. What is life about anyway? My needs? That can't be. I can't be created with needs so that I spend 100 years pursuing my needs. It just doesn't make sense. So we've gotten a lot more insightful about ourselves. We are here just to keep being here. We have to eat, we have to drink, we have to make money, we have to pay bills, just so that we can eat and drink and pay bills again. There's got to be more to life than that.
And we will explore that with Rabbi Manas Friedman, exactly what there is to life, when we come back here on Too Jewish in just a moment. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit our website, twojewishradio.com, TOOJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website, streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcast, top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, over 100,000 downloads on Podbean. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So you have an international Jewish experience to share that took place in the good old United States of America. Tell us about it, would you?
Right. I spent this past Shabbat in Seattle which sounds a lot less exotic than many of the destinations on which I normally report. But I had what for most American Jews would be a very exotic experience there. My close friends, with whom I always stay in Seattle, are an example of an intermarriage between a German Ashkenazic Jew and a Syrian Orthodox Jew from the Brooklyn community of Syrians. And they are very observant of all things Shabbat, Kashrut, et cetera, et cetera. But during COVID time, my friend David was not comfortable not going to a minyan, but he also didn't want to go to a synagogue with a whole bunch of people in a sealed up room. So he's got a neighbor who created officially a synagogue in his home, and they have small minyans. At least half the people there are doctors. The adults are all fully vaccinated, so they were not wearing masks. The kids under 15 have not yet been vaccinated, so they were wearing masks. But, I mean, it was a total of maybe 20 people. It wasn't a huge crowd, and it was in a room that had like giant screen doors open to the fresh air and gorgeous views and lots of air circulating. So I felt totally comfortable on that score. On the other hand, almost all these people have origins in either Turkey or Greece, somewhere in the Ottoman Empire.
So, and Sephardic Jews.
Yes. With a couple of exceptions. And I, well, you know me. So during the Kiddush, which was made by my friend's wife in honor of the fact that it was his bar mitzvah parsha and he read from the Torah and Haftorah, I went around and met people and said, like, what's your story? So the prayer book they use is designed for the Seattle Sephardic community. And there are notes someplace that are, there's a T or an R. Jews from Turkey do this. Jews from Rhodes do this. Because that's the source of the vast majority of these Jews. On the other hand, the guy in whose home this was is purely Moroccan. His family's been in Morocco since long before there was an Islam and long before there was a Jewish community in Sfarad, and they do not come from Sfarad. They're sort of a Edot HaMizrach. I think one parent of his is from Casablanca and one is from Marrakesh. And his son was the Shaliach Tzibur, did a great job. But you hear these really exotic tunes for us, to our ears, and you see a completely different shape of Sefer Torah, which is hard for an Ashkenazic Jew to read altogether.
Well, it's standing up in a case, right?
Right. I mean, you have to kind of bend your knees.
Yeah.
It's
a different reading experience.
It's physically hard. But everybody there is a very regular worshiper. So they all know where they are. They don't need page announcements, whatever. And what was so interesting, in addition to getting everybody's story, was that the host, like many Sephardic Jews, although he's not technically, he's a Edot HaMizrach, has a big collection of araks. So at Kiddush, there was a grapefruit-flavored arak and a cherry-flavored arak, stuff I've never had.
Right.
And he has never had an audience as appreciative as yours truly. So we really hit it off over his exotic
araks, right?
Collection. But I found myself looking around the room and imagining that 1,000 years ago, most of these people were living in either Cordoba or Andalusian territory that was ruled from Cordoba. And they went through this amazing journey after the expulsion in 1492. They went somewhere in the Ottoman Empire and then in many cases somewhere else and somewhere else. And then they lived there for 400 or 500 years. And then somehow in the course of the last century, they all ended up in Seattle.
Overlooking and they're all in Lake this, Washington.
Right? All in this neighborhood called Seward Park, which is absolutely gorgeous. And they have created an incredible, dynamic, warmly welcoming community.
Fascinating. What a great story. Thanks, Duff. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A rabbi walks into a bar. He has a long beard. He's wearing tzitzis, the fringes on the corners of his clothes, a long black coat. He's the whole package. And he has a frog on his head. The bartender asks, "Where did you get that?" And the frog answers, "Brooklyn. They're everywhere." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the Torah portion of Balak in the book of Numbers, which includes some of the best words an outsider ever delivered about the Jewish people. Balak is one of just three portions in the entire Torah named after a non-Jew. The others, in case you were wondering, are Noah, Judaism, being a Hebrew or an Israelite, that doesn't begin until Abraham, so Noah wasn't Jewish. Yitro, Jethro, Moses' Midianite father-in-law, and then this week, Balak. Both of those earlier Torah portions are incredibly important, the portion of Noah for the flood and the first covenant with humanity, and Yitro, for the, well, Ten Commandments. Balak, this week's Sedra, turns out to be important, too. The rabbis saw this section as a kind of separate text, the Sefer Bilam, the scroll or book of Balaam. It's a kind of break in the narrative style of Torah, since unlike virtually the whole of the rest of the five books, Balaam is not told from the perspective of the Israelites or their ancestors. This Balak is a story being told about non-Israelites trying to deal with an obviously upcoming Israelite invasion. When our portion of Balak begins, 40 years of wandering have passed, and the Israelites finally have arrived at the borders of the land of Canaan. They're about to move in and conquer it all. They seem unstoppable to their opponents. Balak, Melech Moab, the king of Moab, comes up with a novel plan. He will hire Balaam, a pagan sorcerer, to curse the Israelites, which will destroy their chances of defeating his own army and entering his land. Only the scheme fails. Balaam may be a polytheistic prophet, but he's also an honest man who conveys only what God permits him to say. After consulting the Almighty, Balaam agrees to do the deed for Balak, but only if God allows him to do so. And so we are given the intriguing spectacle of Balaam the sorcerer, three times trying to curse the people of Israel, only to find that the words that come out of his mouth aren't curses, but blessings. The last of these orations is a text that's become the prayer we use whenever we enter a synagogue. Ma tovu ohalecha Yaakov. How good are your tents, Jacob, your homes, Israel. Somehow, the best laid plans of Israel's enemies go awry, transformed by the hand of God. Without being too deterministic, we know that in recent decades, many nations and organizations have planned the destruction of our Jewish people and of our country, Israel. Their efforts have injured us, but ultimately we have triumphed. Perhaps more importantly, the personal message of this portion of Balak is subtle. Usually in life we intend to bring blessing, but often bring tzoras, trouble instead. But if we rely on God's help and inspiration, we will find that even our less than nobly motivated actions may bring blessing in the place of curses. It's all a matter of remembering the true source for inspiration and creativity, and therefore of blessing, which is God. When we return, Rabbi Manus Friedman, philosopher, author, rabbi, scholar, and deep thinker, will tell us what we should learn from this past year of pandemic, but probably didn't. Find out when we come back on Too Jewish in just a moment.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, after a dozen years, many, many elections, various scandals and prosecutions, and enough controversy to sink a lesser politician many times over, Now, finally this past week, Bibi Netanyahu has truly disappeared from the prime minister's office in Israel. On Monday of last week, the new coalition government, and what a coalition it is, survived its first test, and the prime minister of Israel, officially as of last week, is Naftali Bennett. Netanyahu, you have heard of, and know well by now, perhaps too well, but just who is Naftali Bennett, the newly minted prime minister? Bennett was born in Haifa in 1972, making him one of the younger prime ministers in Israel's history at the age of 49. His parents moved from San Francisco to Israel during the euphoric period following the Six-Day War. Bennett was raised mostly in Haifa, with a couple of two-year stints growing up in the U.S. and Canada when his dad's work as a real estate professional took the family there. Bennett's family was modern Orthodox, as are most Orthodox Jews in Israel, and Naftali Bennett, as a modern Orthodox Jew, is the very first prime minister of Israel who is religious and wears a kippah all the time. After graduating from a modern Orthodox high school, a yeshiva in Haifa, and serving as a youth leader in the Bnei Akiva movement, Bennett went into the IDF, the Israeli military. He served with great distinction in two elite units, Sayeret Matkal and the Maglan commando units, as a unit commander, often in charge of operations behind enemy lines. Bennett saw action in a number of conflicts, particularly in Lebanon, operating against Hezbollah. In between, he got his law degree at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. After his military service was completed, Bennett moved to New York. He started a high-tech firm specializing in fraud prevention and internet security. The firm he co-founded was later sold for $145 million, which made Bennett a multimillionaire. He later founded another high-tech firm, eventually selling out for over $100 million, too. In the course of that high-tech work, he was called back into service in the IDF as a reserve commander and saw considerable military action. In 2011, Naftali Bennett moved into politics. His rise was rapid. He staked out a position on the Israeli right, supporting settlers and opposing a Palestinian state, started right-wing political parties, and rose into several Netanyahu cabinets. Israeli politics is a very messy business, and in one of Israel's manifold elections over the last 2 years, after Bennett had left Netanyahu in a snit, Bennett's party didn't even cross the threshold to get him into the Knesset. He looked like he would be in the semi-permanent political wilderness of fallen Israeli political princes. But Naftali Bennett rebounded in the next election in a right-wing party with fellow ex-Netanyahu aides and acolytes, whose primary purpose became getting rid of Bibi, finally. In the last election, this high-tech entrepreneurs' party gained 7 seats in the Knesset. That proved to be just enough for the larger parties in this anti-Bibi coalition to offer Bennett the prime ministership for 2 years, with a planned rotation to centrist Yair Lapid, a former TV newsman and author, coming up in 2023. You know, maybe Lapid will succeed Bennett. It's like everything in Israeli politics. Anyway, while Bennett's rhetoric over the years has been pro-settler and anti-Arab, most who know him believe this is partly for show, and that he is a pragmatist and has the potential to be a very successful prime minister. Bahatzlacha, Naftali Bennett. The best of luck to you and to Israel. Now, I know I've been talking about Israeli politics a lot lately here on Too Jewish, but I have to add one little coda on the long reign of Bibi Netanyahu. The truth is that he has been in most ways a very successful prime minister indeed, as these things go. Over his 12 years in office, Israel's economy has mostly blossomed, without any severe recession or depression until COVID-19, even when the rest of the world's economies cratered. Israel hasn't had to fight a major war on Bibi's watch. It has successfully suppressed a variety of terrorist attacks and initiatives, signed more treaties with Muslim countries, including Arab ones, than under any previous prime minister. And Israel has the most successful rate of coronavirus vaccination of any first world country and has reopened fully. And it has also navigated the treacherous times as well as it ever has. It stands poised to continue its dramatic rise to a technology and economic powerhouse, even if it's not a very big country. So, in our epitaphs for Bibi Netanyahu's political career, by the way, I first met Netanyahu when he was a rising political star back in the mid-90s. He is as articulate an Israeli leader as you will ever meet, maybe any kind of leader, in both Hebrew and English. Anyway, we must balance Bibi Netanyahu's talent for political expediency, demagoguery, loose moral fiber, and habit of breaking all promises he made to all Israeli politicians, as well as some American and European ones, with a solid record of achievements. King Bibi may be dead, or maybe just removed for now, who knows. But he did accomplish a great deal for Israel, on the positive side too. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews round the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Rabbi Manus Friedman, who is the author of The Joy of Intimacy, A Soulful Guide to Love, Sex, and Marriage, and a variety of other books on how to live. We're talking about the lessons we've learned over this past year of pandemic. You mentioned that some couples have experienced tremendous tension being locked in together, and others have rediscovered one another. What do you think the difference is in the approach between those two results?
I guess it depends on how serious the issue was to begin with. But if you just stop and consider, when we first heard that there was going to be a quarantine or lockdown, that we were going to be locked in the house with our children, with our spouses, we panicked. We couldn't believe it. Because it's not doable. We can't be in the house with the kids for that many hours. It's not going to work. Now, looking back at that, it's like scary that do the children know that we dread the thought of being with them for more than 5 hours at a time? If they know this, doesn't that explain their anger or their frustrations or their insecurities? And the couples, husband and wife, are going to be stuck with each other is a horrible thought. What is it with us? It's got to get better than that. So that was a wake-up call, very sharp. What are we doing? What kind of lives are we living? And we thought that was normal. In fact, we thought that was success. So we've discovered that it's actually quite pleasant to have the kids home. We got to know them for the first time. We realized that they're a lot smarter than we thought. You know, the schools told us that they're not so studious, they're not doing so well. Attention deficits. It's not true. When they're home and they're reading or studying or doing a project that they choose, they have perfect concentration. Nothing wrong with their attention span. So it's the schools that are failing.
You know,
that changes everything.
It does change everything. I'm thinking about the fact that we're going to continue to offer distance learning, right? We're going to continue to offer access to Shabbat services, at least to watch them broadcast now. There's no reason not to, now that we've learned this technology. That gives people a capacity to connect, but it also gives people a capacity to choose. If they don't like the way that local schools are doing what they're doing, they can go see all kinds of other models out there, can't they?
So what improvement will that bring?
Does it give people the opportunity to say, hey, they're doing this in such a different way in this other place that I looked at. Can't you do that here? I mean, isn't that a positive possibility?
Yes. There are many positives, many. I just hope we take advantage of them. And learn the main lesson. The main lesson for the world is that we don't own the needs that we think we have. Just a quick example. A kid goes off to yeshiva. He arrives overseas, goes into the office, and says to the dean, to the Rosh Yeshiva, "I need to call my mother. Which phone can I use?" And the dean says, "You need to call your mother?" He says, "Yeah, I need to call my mother." And the dean says, "Let's try this again. You need to call your mother?" So he thought quickly, and he said, "Actually, my mother needs me to call her." And the Rosh Yeshiva said, "Ah, now you're talking like a mensch." There's a huge difference. Why is it a teenager's need to call his mother when it's really his mother who needs him to call? And that's a lesson in life. Do we really have needs? I need to survive. Do I really? Why? Just because I'm afraid of death? That's not a good reason to live. So when you think about it, the Torah is telling us, you don't have needs. The Creator created you and fashioned you with a need for food, for drink, for sleep. Those are not your needs. Those are the handicaps that God saddled you with. For some reason, He needs you to eat and sleep and drink. This is all His design. If you created yourself, you wouldn't choose to be dependent on food. So to call it my need is like the teenage boy saying he needs to call his mother. We have to realize that we've got it backwards. We've been told for thousands of years how needy we are, how dependent we are, how fragile. It's a bad, depressing message. And it's not the truth. Religion actually made it worse. Religion emphasized and harped on this. You can't do anything yourself. You're helpless. You better be on God's good side or you're finished. You're lost. So get down on your knees and beg. Oh, it's so depressing.
Well, it is.
It is. And modern psychology didn't make things better. They just gave you a whole new level of needs that were subconscious. And then we're told that when you die, you're going to have needs then too. It's horrible.
So
the real message at Mount Sinai was that God came down the mountain because He has a need. At Mount Sinai, we didn't discover what we needed. We discovered what He needs. That's called revelation. And we are here to serve Him. So factually, I don't need to eat. I don't need anything. I didn't ask to be born. I didn't need to be born. And sometimes I really don't care. And I'm not suicidal or depressed. I'm just making an observation.
So that's a very interesting statement and a different approach, because the hierarchy of needs, which is sometimes reversed. So if it's that God needs us to do certain things, to be connected, committed to a covenantal relationship, so then how does that transform the way that we think and act?
I think that when we understand ourselves better, This is not a theological problem. We don't understand ourselves. It's like we're convinced that we have all these needs. The primary need is love. We need to be loved. And we completely forgot that the only need we really have is to be needed.
Say that again.
Our only need is to be needed. We need to know why we're here and that our being here is significant. It doesn't matter whether you love me. What matters is, do I make a difference? So instead of telling our children how much we love them, we need to tell them how much we need them. Because a human being would rather be needed than loved. It's a very simple equation.
But isn't that a little bit... But Rabbi Friedman, isn't that a little bit paradoxical, right? In other words, it's not our needs that matter. It's everybody else's need for us.
If I need to call my mother, there's nothing noble about that.
No.
But if my mother needs me to call her,
and I
am trying to fulfill her need, there's something noble about that.
So that...
if I'm fulfilling God's need, it explains everything. But if I'm just here to satisfy my needs, and I'm not successful at that, because who is? Who really has everything they need? Then life is very frustrating and meaningless. So rather than tell me that I'm not necessary but lovable, tell me I'm necessary and right now you don't love me. Then I have a reason to continue living. But to be loved and not needed, that's a gerbil. It's a cute little animal. You don't need it, but they're lovable.
Cute little hamster or gerbil. But you don't really need it, but it's cute.
So you're God's plaything.
So maybe the best lesson out of all of this, out of this coronavirus Soros, is simply to define how we can make a difference, who we can help, how we can be needed in this world, and then value.
Yes. Yes.
It's beautiful.
And it is so obvious that this whole virus business, it's all God's doing, because we haven't figured out what it is yet. We don't know what we're doing.
No, no. I think that's clear. Although I will say,
mystery.
It's only helpful if we learn the lesson. I want to thank Rabbi Manus Friedman for a great and fascinating visit here on Too Jewish. And where can people go to find out more about your books and your work and to learn more from you?
Go to itsgoodtoknow.org. It's good to know.
It is indeed. Thank you so much.
Thank you for the opportunity.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson. Enterprise of the Pasquayaki tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this summer. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has already created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services Friday night and Saturday, youth education and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha's synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road on the north side of Ina, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property in our very own building. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Join us in person Friday night and Saturday morning. You can come by emailing me, rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org, or just show up. Join us every Friday night in person or on our Facebook page for Shabbat Live Evening Celebration Services at 6:30 p.m., Saturday Shabbat Morning Torah Studies at 9 a.m., and services are at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Our Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, Beitsimcha Tucson, and we will continue to hold our services with full music in person and by virtual experience weekly. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are live and on Zoom. You can access those by emailing rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org. And our wonderful religious school is available in blended formats, some students live and some on Zoom. Sign up now. In fact, for more information about Congregation Beit Simcha, to attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes programs, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation, high school programs, and rich array of adult education academy courses and outreach classes to become Jewish if you want, all taught in person and on Zoom, and of course, all of our wonderful services in person or on Facebook. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest and fastest-growing Jewish community and synagogue in all of southern Arizona in its exciting and fun beginning years. Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be Eliza D. Lewin, president of the Louis D. Brandeis Center, addressing anti-Semitism on campus, and a lawsuit against Stanford University for anti-Semitism in its Counseling and Psychological Services Division. Very important work. Our playout this morning comes from Mordechai Shapiro, and it mirrors the theme of my own congregation, Beit Simcha, Ivdu et Hashem b'simcha, serve God with joy. Great advice, now and always. And don't forget, you can join us at Congregation Beit Simcha this Friday night for services and an Oneg Shabbat, all starting at 6:30 p.m. and Saturday morning, too, 9 a.m. for Torah study in person and on Zoom, or 10 a.m. for services and Torah reading in person and on Facebook. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, a cool week, and a week, we pray, of health and of peace.
sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.